Defending Your Nash is a show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, Harold Felder. Today we have a very good show for you. Today we're going to talk about the reliability of the New Testament and why I should we believe that the New Testament is actually accurate. To talk with me about this is Frank Turek. Frank Turek has a master's degree in public administration. He has a master's in apologetics from Southern Evangelical Seminary, but he's about to finish his doctoral work.
Right there. The same day you're going to finish your master's work.
Same day I finished my master's. You're absolutely right. He's also assistant pastor of Southern Evangelical Church. He's been in the Navy.
That's right.
Something we have in common.
That's right.
He's written two award-winning books. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, which is one of my favorites. And you have that there. And Legislating Morality. He's been on numerous TV shows. He's been on the O'Reilly Factor, Hannity and Combs, Politically Incorrect, Faith Under Fire, Fox News, and just, you know, more and more.
And I've been on Giving an Answer, too.
Yeah, now you have arrived.
No, I was on before, man.
That's true. You're right. You're actually right. Matter of fact, I'm put at the top
that's
of the
right.
Right above the O'Reilly
there
Factor.
There you go. There you go.
Right.
That's a resume grabber, baby.
So is there anything else that I left out that you would like
no,
to...
No, man, I'm married to the lovely Stephanie, three boys.
All right.
17, 14, and 12.
Okay, great. So let's get to it.
All right.
Let's start off with, what is the basic New Testament message?
Well, the basic New Testament message is that Jesus came and died and rose from the dead for our sins. I mean, if you look at the whole Bible, paradise lost in Genesis becomes paradise regained in Revelation, and the anticipated Messiah throughout the Old Testament actually comes to earth, and that's what the New Testament tells us about. Basically, if you had to sum up the Bible in one word, I think you could sum it up with the word redemption. We're redeemed. We're lost. We're redeemed because Christ comes and pays the price for our sins.
Now, that's the message of the New Testament.
Yeah.
But how do we know that what we have now mm-hmm. is an accurate copy of what was actually transmitted 2,000 years
ago? That's a good question. And what we try and do in our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, is point out that there are two questions we need to answer when we're trying to talk about whether or not the Bible that we read today is accurate.
Right.
Question number one is, do we have an accurate copy? That's the question you just mentioned. Because we don't have the originals. We only have copies.
Right.
Question number two is, how do we know the copy told the truth?
Right.
Or the original told the truth?
Right.
I mean, we can have an accurate copy of a lie.
Right.
That doesn't mean it's true, right?
Right.
Now, with regard to the first question, how do we know we have an accurate copy? Because we have so many manuscript copies of the original. We don't have the original, but we have copies of them. That when we compare them, we can reconstruct the original with a great, great degree of accuracy, over 99% degree of accuracy.
Right.
And the 0.5% we don't quite know about doesn't affect any doctrine. Not only that, Harold, but if you could destroy every manuscript out there and destroy every Bible in existence, you could still reconstruct the entire New Testament just from the quotations of the early church fathers. These early Christians who quoted the Bible so much in, say, the late 100s or the 100s, 200s, and 300s.
Right.
They quoted it so much that you can recreate the entire Bible except for 11 verses, the entire New Testament except for 11 verses. And most of those verses that they didn't quote were in 3 John.
Yeah.
Now, not that 3 John isn't important, but when was the last time you heard somebody say, hey, got a verse for you, it's 3 John?
Right.
People don't even know. There's a 3 John in here? What are you talking about?
Yeah, right.
So we know what the original said. The question is, how do we know the original told the truth? That's the second question.
Right.
That's the more important question.
Right, because like you say, it could have been a bunch of lies.
Yeah, it could be fables, lies, yeah.
So, I mean, so how do we know that? Then how do we know that that when the apostles or the New Testament writers, how do we know that what they wrote down wasn't just some fiction, some myth that they made up?
Right. Good question. The bottom line to the whole thing, and you hear this a lot, you hear people say, and in fact, I heard it on a TV program once where it was like one of these Discovery Channel Search for Jesus things, you know, and the narrator came on and said something like, what we think we know about Jesus, we know mostly from the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But we can't trust those Gospels for accurate information because those Gospels were written by the converted. And I thought to myself, there's something wrong with that logic. What's wrong with that logic? What's wrong with the logic is, why were they converted?
Right.
You know, why did they write this down and then go to their death saying it was true? See, the New Testament writers had every motive to say that the New Testament, that the miracles Jesus did, and particularly the resurrection, was not true. Not every motive to say it was. Because by saying it was true, they got beaten, tortured, and killed. Now, last time I checked, that was not a list of perks.
Right.
You know, these people weren't making it up, because if they made it up, they made it up to get themselves beaten, tortured, and killed. That makes no sense.
Right.
Now, we can look at other aspects. We know we have early testimony in there. We have eyewitness testimony, and we have authentic testimony because of how they behaved when they wrote it down.
And another thing I wanted to mention is that you mentioned the fact that they wouldn't have made it up because of the ramifications.
Sure.
And that's a very interesting point I want people to be able to be able to grasp, because people do, you know, believe in a lie.
Oh,
and people
sure they do.
People do die for a lie.
Oh, yeah.
But people do not die for what they know is a lie.
Right.
So if the gospel writers made this up, that means that they knew it was a lie, mm-hmm. and they died for what they knew it was a lie, and you don't find that happening.
No, no. And you even know from non-Christian sources that the basic New Testament storyline is true. From non-Christian sources, and we document them in the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, there's 10 ancient non-Christian sources between, or that have written within 150 years of Jesus' life. Household names like Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius, Thallus, Phlegon. These are all non-Christian sources. Even the Jewish Talmud says that Jesus, Yeshua, died on the eve of the Jewish Passover because he was hung on a tree, and they hung him on a tree because he led Israel astray for practicing sorcery. So they knew he did something unusual. They just didn't want to call it a miracle.
Right.
You know,
right.
So even through non-Christian sources, we get the same basic storyline as the New Testament. When you put those 10 non-Christian sources together and line them up, you get the same story that the New Testament gives. Now, these non-Christian writers don't say Jesus rose from the dead. They say his disciples believed he rose from the dead,
right.
And his disciples went to die for their belief, which tells us that why would the disciples do that? They had every motive to say it wasn't true, not every motive to say it was.
Right. And this leads me to the next thing. You have in your book the top 10 reasons why we know that they told the truth.
Right.
Could you go through those?
Well, the first one is, of course, that the non-Christian writers say basically the same thing. We know that, okay? That would be number one. I don't know if we have time to go through all 10 of them, but let me give you another one. The non-Christian writers say basically the same thing, but the Christian writers, the guys who wrote the New Testament, include embarrassing details about themselves and about Jesus.
Yeah.
Now, there's a principle of historicity, looking at history to try and determine what is true and what isn't true when you read a history book, and it's called the principle of embarrassment, which means that if you see something in the text that's embarrassing to the author or authors, it's probably true. Why? Because if you and I are making up a story,
right.
we're not going to write stuff in there that makes us look stupid,
right.
are we?
We're not going to say that, you know, Jesus called us Satan.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That Jesus called Peter Satan.
Right.
I mean,
right.
that's just embarrassing.
Right.
Don't you think that if, you know, that didn't really happen, Peter would have gone over to Mark and said, hey, Mark, you know the part about the Lord calling me Satan? Can we leave that out? That doesn't need to be in the text here, does it?
Right.
There's so many embarrassing things. They're dim-witted. How many times are they?
Yeah.
They don't even know what Jesus is talking about.
Right.
They're uncaring. They fall asleep in the garden the night before he's about to be crucified. They don't even give him a proper burial. They all run away at the crucifixion. Who are the only brave ones?
The women.
The women. The women hang around. And the women are the first ones that go and discover the empty tomb. Now, we know that wouldn't have been made up because a woman's testimony in a court of law in that culture was considered inadmissible.
Right.
Not only that, but consider this. If you and I were making up a story, men, manly men, would we ever say that the women were the first witnesses while we were hiding for fear of the Jews?
I don't think so.
No, no. We would probably write, we bravely marched right down there and moved that Roman guard out of the way. And then we saw Jesus, who congratulated on our great faith. And then we went back and we comforted the trembling women.
Right.
Right. That's how we would write
exactly.
it.
Right, right.
We wouldn't say we were hiding while the women were the brave ones, especially when their evidence or their testimony was considered inadmissible in a court of law.
Yeah.
So that's another. Embarrassing details are one.
Yeah. That's a really good point. Really good point.
Another embarrassing detail. Think about the embarrassing details in there about Jesus. Do you know that Jesus in the New Testament is called by people in the New Testament, he's called a drunkard, he's called demon-possessed. His own family thinks he's out of his mind in Mark chapter 3. They come to take him away. His own family doesn't believe in him.
Right.
They say his own brothers don't believe in him, John 7:5. He has his hair or his feet wiped with the hair of a prostitute, which easily could have been seen as a sexual advance. Right. He also is hung on a tree, despite the fact that according to Deuteronomy 21, anyone who's hung on a tree is under God's curse. And that's one reason, by the way, that the Jews would never make up a story about their Messiah being a sacrificial Messiah, like Jesus being hung on a tree, because according to their own Old Testament, such a man is under God's curse. Now, of course, he was under a curse, our curse, because our sin, we put him there. But if you were making up a story, you would have some guy come in on a white horse and slay the Romans.
Right.
Not a guy who would be born in a manger or laid in a manger and then, you know, die a brutal death for nothing.
I know another interesting thing, that when we read the gospel accounts, there were even times where Jesus would speak to the people and they didn't receive him. They would reject him. They would say, oh, this is a hard saying. Who can accept this?
That's right.
Now, why would somebody make that story up? Why would somebody make up the story that Jesus, that the people who Jesus was preaching to himself, a lot of them just rejected him?
Not only that, but why would they make up the story, as you mentioned, with regard to this is a hard teaching? One of the teachings that is found in John chapter 6 is basically when he says, if you want to follow me, you must eat my flesh and drink my blood. And that's where they said, man, this is a hard teaching. We can't follow this. And a lot of his disciples, it says, at that point, followed him no longer.
Right.
Which is another example of an authentic detail that wouldn't have been made up in a story, particularly in a story that the critics say is made up to make Jesus look good and look like God. That's the last thing that they're trying to do. They're just trying to tell people what happened.
Another thing that you mentioned when you were talking about, you know, if me and you were making stuff up, some of the things we were saying we wouldn't say. For instance, if I was making it up, fornication wouldn't be a problem.
No, that's right.
Yeah, I would be like, oh, okay, that's purely acceptable. Uh-huh. You know? And there were a lot of things that Jesus said, you know, a lot of standards that he had, high moral standards that he had for the people. He had so his standards were so high that the disciples couldn't even live up to them.
Yeah.
So why in the world would the disciples make up something, you know, that they couldn't even aspire to?
Especially at the time when Matthew wrote down the Gospel of Matthew, the Christians were probably under persecution at that point. Yet in Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, he records Jesus as saying to pray for your enemies, love those who persecute you, bless those who persecute you, pray for them. Where human beings under our own human nature would want to not love our enemies, but retaliate, go after them.
Right, right, right.
And yet here's Matthew recording, this is what Jesus said. He must have really said it.
And Jesus said, really, really difficult things, even if you think badly about your brother. I mean, like we were talking before, the Old Testament was talking about, you know, it's a sin to murder your brother. But Jesus was like, you know, even if you call him a certain name, then you could be guilty of basically the same thing.
Or if you even think about adultery, you're guilty.
Right, right, right.
What man hasn't thought about that?
Right, and I mean, that's not something I would write up.
No,
I mean,
no, you know, no, absolutely not.
I may have been like, okay, you can fornicate 3 or 4 times, and after that, that's something I would have came up with myself. You know,
there's a limit.
Right. Sort of like, you know, the interesting thing, like, for instance, Muhammad. Muhammad, when, you know, he was talking about how many wives you could have.
Yeah.
Now, for himself, there was an exception to the rule.
Muhammad could have 15 and everyone else could only have 4.
Right, right. That's the type of thing I would have made up.
Yeah.
You know, okay.
Yeah. That's not a good deal for the women over there.
No.
No.
No, that's not a good deal at all.
No, not a good deal at all. So.
But, of course, there are objections, you know.
Whether this was true or not?
Yeah. The whole reliability of the New Testament.
Yeah.
There are objections to them.
Well, give me a couple of them. Let's talk about
them.
Okay. What are some objections we get here?
The New Testament contains miracles.
Yeah.
Miracles are impossible. Miracles don't happen.
All right, let me back up then. What's the greatest miracle in the Bible? And if you're thinking Jonah or something crazy like that, that's nothing. The greatest miracle in the Bible, as you know, Harold, is Genesis 1:1.
Right.
If Genesis 1:1 is true, that the universe exploded into being out of nothing, then every other miracle in the Bible is believable. Why? Because the universe exploded into being out of nothing. That's not just what the Bible says. That's what modern science now says.
Right.
The Big Bang says that the universe, all space, all time, all matter, came into existence out of nothing at some time in the distant past. In other words, there was no time, there was no space, there was no matter, there was no natural world that we know. There was nothing. What is nothing? Aristotle had a good definition of nothing. Nothing is what rocks dream about.
Right.
And then something, this universe, exploded into being with great precision, I might add, and here we are. So if the natural world did not exist, if time did not exist, if space did not exist, if matter did not exist, and then suddenly it came into existence, there must be something outside of time, space, and matter, something outside of nature, i.e. something supernatural that brought it into existence. That's exactly what we call God. And that being must be timeless, must be immaterial, must be powerful, must be intelligent, also must be moral, because there's a moral argument that impinges on us, and he must be personal in order to make a choice to go from a state of non-existence to existence. So if that verse is true, Genesis 1:1, and the evidence shows that it is, then you can believe any other verse in the Bible, because miracles not only are possible, they're actual. They've already occurred.
And the point that you make is that miracles are by definition supernatural, and the creation of the universe is by definition supernatural, because there was no natural, there was no nature, so it had to be supernatural.
Right.
So that's already been established.
Right. Not only that too, but a lot of times you get the objection this way: well, I haven't seen a miracle, or we don't seem to see miracles like, you know, parting the Red Sea, or, you know, it'd be on the Fox News Channel if we did see it. And of course, the answer to that is you have to look at what the purpose of miracles are.
Yeah.
The purpose of miracles in the Bible appears to be, and even the Quran, believe it or not, agrees with this, a miracle is a validation of a new revelation from God. In other words, how does God tell everybody that he's got a new word that we ought to listen to? What he does is he pours out miracles on certain people who are speaking for him, like Moses, like Elijah, and like Jesus and the apostles. If you look at the Bible, there are about 300 miracles throughout the Bible, but they're bunched.
Yeah,
bunched around Moses, they're bunched around Elijah, and they're bunched around Jesus and the apostles. Why? Because they all have new revelation. If this canon now is closed and there's no more new revelation, there's no need for any more miracles. Now, I'm not saying God can't do a miracle today or that he doesn't do miracles today. He can, and maybe he does.
Right.
He can, because he owns the natural world and can intervene at any time, but he doesn't have any purpose to do miracles to confirm new revelation like he did in the Bible. And that's maybe why we don't see them like we did back then.
Right. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Now, another objection is the fact that, okay, the New Testament was written centuries after the event. The church came up with it. I think this is popular with the Da Vinci Code.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's just something made up by man.
Yeah.
And how do you respond to that?
That's nonsense. We know the New Testament documents, the majority of them. First of all, we know all of them are written by 100 A.D. Why? Because 25 out of 27 are quoted by 110 A.D. I mean, they're quoted in other sources, so they had to have been written at least by around 100.
Yeah.
We know that most, if not all, are written prior to 70 A.D. How do we know? Because the greatest disaster in the history of Israel occurred in 70 A.D., the destruction of the city, the temple, practically their whole country by the Romans, Titus, who came in and destroyed everything. Yet there's not a word in the Bible about the destruction of Jerusalem other than Jesus predicting it, okay, and the temple being destroyed. Now, and of course, there are places in the Bible that seem to indicate that the temple and the city are still standing when they're writing. For example, in John chapter 5, John speaks as if a certain structure is still in existence when he's writing.
Yeah.
Now, here's the analogy. Suppose you were reading a book about the history of New York City, particularly Lower Manhattan, and the book ends and the World Trade towers are still standing. Would you assume the book was written when? Before 9/11.
Right, exactly,
right. Well, the same is true with the Bible, the New Testament, except it was a greater disaster than was 9/11, because they lost not just a couple of prominent buildings. They lost their entire city, many of their villages, their entire temple, which was the center of their political, religious, and economic life, and yet there's no mention of it in that book. And there's mention that those things are still standing when the books are written. So most, if not all, are written by 70, and there's other arguments that show that some of the data in the Bible goes all the way back to the resurrection itself, particularly the creed about the resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15.
Yeah, yeah.
So we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that most of what's in the New Testament is written prior to 70 A.D., and if it's written prior to 70 A.D., it can't be myth, it can't be legend, because the eyewitnesses are still alive to refute.
Another good thing is the fact that in Matthew, Paul actually quotes Matthew in 1 Timothy.
And Luke, yeah.
Right. So if he's quoting Matthew, then Matthew had to be written before that. And not only that, we know that Paul died under the reign of Nero, which ended in 68. So, of course, he had to write before he died.
So I
he had to write
so.
Before 68. Yeah.
I think he may be going out on a limb there.
Right.
He had to write before he died? Okay.
Right.
Yeah, even the critics, even the liberals agree that 1 Corinthians was written by about 55 A.D.
Right.
Which would mean that the data in 1 Corinthians 15, including the creed, which the creed I just mentioned, which is 1 Corinthians 15, 3-8, which goes all the way back to the resurrection itself, was very, very early. This is early eyewitness testimony.
Right.
Even something that's written 55 A.D., if the cross was 30 or 33 A.D., let's say that's outside 25 years, that would be like somebody today writing, what happened 25 years ago? Let's see, what would be 25 years ago, 1980? That would be like, say, someone today writing about the Iranian hostage situation, which occurred in 1979, 1980. Could we go back and interview people who were there?
Yes.
We could even remember it. I can remember what happened myself. I was there.
Yes.
So it's not like you can't write stuff that's accurate about something that happened 25 years ago, especially big impact events like that. You remember them.
You make a very good point there, because there are events in a person's life that molds them. And I've heard you get this talk before, and one of the things you were talking about, for instance, was the space shuttle when it blew up.
Right.
And I know exactly where I was at. I was in Korea. I mean, I was in Japan. I was in the Navy Exchange, and I was looking at the TVs. And I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember where I was at 9/11, and I'm going to remember where I was at 9/11. You know, and those who are old enough remember where they were when Kennedy was assassinated.
Right. Even I was only 2 years old, and I remember my mother crying before the TV. Why? Psychologically, an impact event. The resurrection, if it occurred, was an impact event.
Right.
Those people remembered it, and of course, the Bible also says. Jesus also promises the New Testament writers, the apostles, that the Holy Spirit would bring to their remembrance things that he told them.
Right.
We know that what's in here is accurate historically. The question is, will we accept it?
Right.
See, that's the real question.
Right.
We know what's in here really happened. The question is, will we say, I'm going to put my faith in Christ. I'm not just going to believe that he existed and that he did those things, but I'm going to put my faith and trust in him so my sins can be forgiven. That's the next step.
Because there are a lot of people who will look at the evidence and realize that the evidence is very strong. And people will say sometimes, well, if the evidence is so strong, then why don't more people come to Christ?
Hmm.
It's because it's a matter of the will.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's free will. People don't want to come to Christ because they think they're going to have to give something up in their life they don't want to give up. Or they're going to have to change their friends, they think, or they're going to have to stop doing what they're doing, or they're going to have to bow before a creator rather than their own, you know, their own needs, desires, and wants. In fact, what someone once said, the problem with the self-made man is that he worships his creator.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We all want to do our own thing. And so we don't want to bow our knee before a holy God. We want to do our own thing. So it's more a matter of the will than the mind.
Yeah. I remember I was raised in church, and I remember... I guess I wasn't an atheist, but I really wasn't. You know, I wasn't saved, that's for sure. I would pray occasionally. But I remember the last time I prayed was in boot camp, because I needed prayer in boot camp. But then once I got to, like, the Philippines, once I got to places where there were things I wanted to do that conflicted with that, then I became an atheist.
Oh, yeah, right.
Not because, you know, I came across some revelation, but because the belief in God didn't fit with the lifestyle
that
I wanted to live.
That was getting in the way,
exactly.
Huh? That's right. God getting the back, man.
Right, exactly. So I know exactly what you mean.
Uh-huh.
Now, here's another objection. We were talking about the Gospels, but a lot of critics will say, we don't even know who wrote the Gospels.
Oh, sure we know who wrote the Gospels. In fact, there's an unbroken chain of testimony from John through Polycarp, through Irenaeus. And Polycarp and Irenaeus, particularly Irenaeus, identified who the four Gospel writers were. And so we know John, or all the way to Irenaeus, as to who those Gospel writers were. We also know through Eusebius, an historian in the 2nd century, actually 3rd century, through a writing that he had from Pappus, he also identified who the writers were. So we know who wrote the Gospels. That's no mystery. The question is, will we accept what's in the Gospels?
Right. And another point that you make is that when the Gospel was written, I mean, they were written to the people of that time.
Sure.
And so these people had to know who they were written by.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, the book of Matthew, they were like, okay, it was written by Matthew.
Yeah.
It's only hundreds of years later that the critics started to look and say, well, we can't tell who wrote this book. Well, they knew who wrote it. They knew exactly who wrote it.
You know, it's the only mystery about who wrote what in the Bible or the New Testament anyway is Hebrews.
Right.
You know, whether Paul wrote it or Apollos or somebody else.
Right.
But that's been authenticated as a book that is inspired because of what it says inside there. But we just don't know who wrote it. We're not sure.
Right.
Other than that, we know who wrote every one of the New Testament books, and there are 27 of them.
Yeah.
That's another thing you got to point out. The New Testament's not a monolithic book. It was written by 8 or 9 different authors, and they wrote 27 different letters or sections, and then the church or the Christians, or I shouldn't say the church because the church didn't officially really do anything till it was legalized by Constantine in 317 AD. The early Christians recognized that those particular 27 writings were inspired.
Right.
And they didn't determine they were inspired. They recognized, they discovered they were inspired because they were written by apostles who confirmed that they were inspired works by doing miracles.
Right, right. That's a very good point. I mean, and because, for instance, I believe it's Galatians, or one of them, maybe it's Corinthians, where Paul is writing to the church, and Paul is saying, you know, I perform miracles.
Second Corinthians 12:2.
Okay,
yeah.
Right. He was talking. Yeah. Now, how do you write 12, to a church and say that you perform miracles if you didn't perform the miracles?
Right. Especially when you're writing back to a church who saw you before and you're going to visit again.
Right.
In 2 Corinthians 12:12, he says, I performed the signs of an apostle before you. He would have lost all credibility if he had written to them and said, remember when I was with you and I performed all those miracles for you?
Right.
So he must have really done miracles.
He must have really, and as you said, even critical scholars will agree that book was written, that Corinthians was written within 20 to 30 years after the death of Christ.
Not only that, and we point this, and I don't have enough point this out, and I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. There are 84 eyewitness details in the second half of the book of Acts. Had to be eyewitness details. I mean, Luke writes things down like wind directions and water depths and obscure rulers in particular places. Had to be an eyewitness account. And he's detailed on all these trivial things. He's accurate on all these trivial things, and we ought to expect him to be accurate on these big things, like miracles he records in the same text. Also, in the Gospel of John, there are 59 historically confirmed or historically probable details in that Gospel.
Right.
That's just two books in the New Testament.
Right.
We know they were eyewitnesses, or they had interviewed eyewitnesses.
Right.
So we have authentic early eyewitness testimony.
Well, Frank, thanks for coming on the show.
That's it, man.
Time is coming.
Man, time flies here and giving an answer.
Fun.
We got to go, bud. Okay.
If anyone wants to know more about Frank, you can visit frankturek.com, right?
That'll do it.
How do you spell the last name?
T-U-R-E-K.
Okay. That's going to do it for this week. Thank you for joining me. Be sure to join me again next week. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
The preceding show has been sponsored by Giving an Answer with your host, H.C. Felder. So you can hear this broadcast as well as other episodes by visiting us online at givinganswer.org. You can also order a CD or a DVD of the studio recording by calling me at 704-248-7840. And remember, this show will only stay on the air if people continue to help us buy airtime. So I encourage you to consider making a tax-deductible financial donation to this ministry. That phone number again is 704-248-7840. And be sure to join me again next time on Giving an Answer.